Hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And in this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me American singer-songwriter Mary Fall. Mary's most recent album, Can't Get It Out of My Head, made my top five albums of 2022 last year. And I can safely say I've been playing it every week since I've had it. It's absolutely a beautiful album with some of my favorite songs on it. Really, really is. So welcome, Mary. Welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast. And how are you?
I'm fine. And it's a little bit of spring in the air today. So I love that. I know you live in Penzance.
Penzance in Cornwall. We're not far from the sea, but it's quite rainy and blustery today.
Okay. Now,
I first became aware of you via a video for Going Home from the album The Outside of Time. The song was played in rotation in the UK on a TV channel, which we had called O Music. I think it was called Classic FM before that. It's about 2004-ish, I think. And I think that was your first album since leaving the October Project.
Roughly. Right. I got signed. You know, after I left October Project, I never wrote music with October Project. I was the singer. That's it. And so I had to learn how to do that. I really did. It was very frightening for me because October Project was a good band. Two albums, but really well done and very soaring, a lot of harmony and everything. So I had to learn how to be a writer. And I put a band together, a band that most of the members ended up forming their own band called Olabel. If you know Olabel, they're fabulous. And but anyway, I gave up trying to get a deal at a certain point. I was playing out with the band. I was trying things, and I thought, well, I'm never going to get a deal, so who cares? And I started performing. I studied medieval history and literature at college, and I started incorporating some of that, little bits here and there, just things I like to do, because I thought, who cares? I don't have to be commercial. And because I did that, I sang a song in sort of a medieval language that's a combination of Spanish and Arabic called Mozarabic. It was from the 11th century. And lo and behold, I came to the attention of Sony Classical because they were looking for something like that, someone who could cross over different genres. And they had me come up and audition, and I did it. But they didn't know what to do with me, but they said, you know, we think you're kind of cinematic, so we'd like you to write for movies. And I saw they were doing this Civil War film, and my dad used to sing these beautiful Stephen Foster songs to us when we were little kids. And so I thought, I'll write a kind of a Stephen Foster song for this movie. And it ended up getting into the film. And that's how I ended up on your television screen. And I will say that that video, I premiered it. I hadn't seen it before I showed it to my family. And they sent me, I'm like, oh, guys, let's watch this together. I didn't realize that there were parts of it where I'm kind of rolling on the ground, and I was very embarrassed. At one point, my brother looked at me, and because when I turned over on the ground, I have sort of very buxom, you know. He said, "You should just put a post-it note on there with your phone number." It's really embarrassing. So anyway, but it's an interesting thing because it confused, that song ended up confusing, I think, radio. And the album itself is very eclectic and a mishmash, but they wanted me to write for movies and sing with an orchestra and do an aria. And so it confused radio. So it is my most popular song if you go on Spotify. But it also, in one way, just it was hard because it kind of ruined me for radio, and they stopped playing my stuff. And so it's odd. I've had an odd career.
Because
that's the story, and I tried to condense it as much as possible.
Very good. So it was, because that album is very, it's like this Celtic, there's English folk, there's classical music, it's operatic. Yeah. It was also, I can see it was a complete melting pot of musical styles. But you were able to write like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but I by the time that came around, I had got more confidence in writing. It's a scary thing because you have to be bad at first. You write a lot of bad songs, at least I did. And then I started to get comfortable and I found my own way. And I like writing for movies or books, or I don't typically like pulling things out of my own life. That album was probably too eclectic, but I love the fact that it takes you on an interesting journey, which is what I like to do in my live shows, really.
It certainly does. But then if that wasn't challenge enough for doing such a varied album and going from not writing anything to writing for film, you then decided to, as you put here in the notes for your DVD, to climb Mount Everest by covering an album that most people wouldn't go near, Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd.
Well, you know, I'm a gutsy girl, okay? Or maybe I just don't know any better, but I had grown up with that album. I had older siblings, and I was a small child in the 60s. So I had teenage siblings that had great and all very different record collections. And so I was privileged to have all of that streaming, but my older brother was the prog person. And I didn't like a lot of his stuff because it was, sometimes it's just too many notes, as you say, I call it boy music, but for me, the Pink Floyd, I could always sing it. And I always resonated with the lyrics and the overall sensibility. So when, my contract was not renewed with Sony Classical. Everyone who I knew had left or got fired, and for various reasons. And I was very disappointed. But I just remember it takes me about 2 months to get over something. And you dry your tears, you put on a little makeup, and I put my favorite hat on. I went into New York and got myself a new manager. And the new management company said, you can either go out and be a girl with a guitar, and there are so many of those, or we can try to do something really interesting. And I said, well, like what? And I said, why don't you redo a classic record? And I was thinking, well, what would I do? I mean, I don't know. That sounds like a terrible idea. And then I was thinking, well, I guess if I were to do one record that has such deep meaning for me, it would have to be Dark Side of the Moon. There you go. And I feel like, whoa. So they put, wisely, they put me together with two producers. And that record, that's I don't even call it sort of a Mary Fall record. It's such, those producers, especially David Werner, who had his own career. He had been an artist called WizKid. He had such a ferocious vision for that record. And I felt so safe with he and Mark Doyle just making this record on spec, basically. I'd drive up to Syracuse and layer by layer, but it was David Werner's vision. And he let me try everything. And so a lot of, I'd say, my philosophical input into that record in terms of the heart, the soul of it, but the music of it was David and Mark, once again, Mark Doyle, who has, been my producer on my last record. And so between Mark and I just were able to just fly and do whatever we wanted. And then we just honed it all down. And then of course, Bob Clearmountain came in on that record. And as a favor to us, he mixed that record and he did the surround mix, which was lost in a fire for years. We thought it was gone. And the label had folded. V2 had folded the record was ever, it's another heartbreaking music industry story. But Mark, during the lockdown, COVID lockdown, Mark, with all that time on his hands, found the surround mix, and we had it remastered. And I just think that surround mix is really stunning. I hadn't heard it in years and oh my God. It's so, because that album is so layered. It's just made for surround,
Yeah, it is.
Every different way.
Yeah. But you're right. It's kind of, although it's seen as a progressive rock classic, it actually has a lot of pop sensibilities in the songs. The songs are very pop orientated, really.
Very much so, yeah.
You know, some wonderful. And I mean, I was listening to it this morning, and I love Us and Them. And Any Colour You Like, which is an instrumental, obviously was, but you take it to a totally different land. Did you have a lot of fun kind of exploring where you could take this music you'd known for so long?
I had a ball making that record because David and Mark, I felt very safe with them. I never felt judged, and they'd say, try this, try that. And for me, I had a spiritual and philosophical through line for me.
Yeah.
For me, that is sort of like Kurt Vile's Seven Deadly Sins. It's a song cycle, kind of a classical cycle. So that's how I saw Dark Side. And I felt it was an allegory of a human life, and that it takes you up and down into the, and back up again. And so I wanted Any Colour You Like to be kind of, I don't want to be airy fairy, but sort of like a shamanic kind of thing, you know, where it's speaking in tongues and that's where I was at when we did that. And for each of those songs, we had to come up with a completely original approach. And like on Money, we tried Money many, many different ways. And first we tried a big band and it's like, no, that didn't work. And then ultimately we came up with that very sort of sinewy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like vulgar. I wanted it to be vulgar.
Yeah.
You know, and when I sang that in particular, I remember overhearing these two women from some foreign country, but they were talking like this, and the woman kept saying, "But it is more money than that." And I thought, "That's what it is. It's money." Okay. Yeah. And so anyway, I had a ball doing that, and it was nice to sort of find it and re-release it. You know, it was really awesome.
You said it was almost like, in some cases, almost like a spiritual experience approaching an album like this. When you look at a song like, gosh, it's just flipping my head, The Great Gig in the Sky, which is a song without words, but a song with so much power and so much feeling and meaning without having a single lyric. How did you approach that? Were you kind of apprehensive?
First of all, I'm not, you know, the original, what was her name? Claire.
Tory.
Claire Tory. I was going to say Claire Trevor, but that's her brief encounter. Okay. The actress. So Claire Tory. And, you know, what she did is so soulful and unique. You can't do that again. And for me at that moment of the song cycle, for me, it's mourning. It's a mourning. It's a mourning song of realization that life is not what you thought it was, or the realization that, oh my God, things are so corrupt. It's all of that hitting you at once, and that dawning on you. And so that's where I was coming from when I sang that. And again, it was just that's the lowest part of the journey. And then you begin to climb back out slowly. And the next song, I think the next song is
Money, isn't it? And Us and Them.
Money.
And then,
and then it becomes that the life enters that period where you are cynical. It's like now you've entered the area of cynicism. And then another realization with Us and Them. The other thing, see, I Roger Waters, I got to tell you, in many ways, the man, it was a prophet. And I think whatever you think of him or his politics or anything, I know he's very interested in World War I and its effects on the rest of the century and the future. And I have an interest in World War I as well. And I really feel like that was the beginning of the end in many, many ways, the decisions that were made and this, you know, and the subsequent fallout. And I feel that with Roger Waters all the time. And so I resonate with his sensibility. I get what he's talking about, at least for me. And so I think that comes across on the record.
No, it's fantastic. And because obviously we're looking at it now, it came out, you, as you say, during lockdown, it was found and it's out now and it's fantastic. It's in Blu-ray 5.1. But of course, it was recorded a long time ago and then you thought it being lost in a fire. And this was coming quite soon after Sony Classical.
Just didn't, I call it did not renew my contract.
there's a gap then where you obviously have to almost find yourself again musically.
Yeah. So The Dark Side was fun. And then, you know, and then I was ready to really give up, completely give up. I really, you know, you get your heart broken a lot. And then I decided, well, I'm going to grow a garden. I'm going to learn how to, because I don't know anything about that. And I should learn. So I threw myself into that. And because of that, I threw this and that and, you know, connections. I ended up meeting my husband and he said, why aren't you playing? Why aren't you out working? And I said, yeah, I'm done. He said, why? And then I said, because what am I going to do? And he said, you're going to go out again. And he just bullied me and bullied me and bullied me until I did it. And I said, I didn't think I was a, I said, I'm going to have to go out by myself with just me and a guitar. And I said, I'm just not a good enough guitar player. And he said, well, then you're going to have to get good. And he dragged me out, Phil. It was so embarrassing to these horrible. And he, my husband has his own life, a big life. He's a research scientist. He's a deep sea oceanographer. He's does all this stuff. Busy. He's a busy, busy guy. He would come home from work and he would drag me out to these awful open mic nights. And, you know, I would say to him, like, I don't do that. Like, you know, the diva comes out. And I'm not really a diva, but it came out. And don't do that. But you know what? He was right. He made me go out and get comfortable just playing by myself and grabbing a rowdy crowd that didn't know me. It was like starting all over again. And grabbing an audience that didn't know who I was, didn't give a damn about anything. And then I got better. And then I started to book shows and more and more and more. And then I started writing again. And I had one of my old friends, John Lissauer, was John Lissauer is featured very prominently in this latest Leonard Cohen documentary, which is very, very good about Hallelujah. And John had worked with Leonard for years. And but he had done all the orchestrations for The Other Side of Time for me. And we got along so well. So he said, why don't we, you know, bring me what you've written and let's put a record together. And he doesn't live that far. So I started working on a record with John. And then I thought, well, I've got to, how am I going to tour this? I got to put a band together. So I went back to Mark Doyle and I said, Mark, can you help me out? Do you want to do this with me? And he did. And he put a band together for me. And he's been my music director ever since. And I'm very, very lucky to have him. He can do anything. And
was that the Love and Gravity album, was it?
Yeah, that was the Love and Gravity record. And then we did our first show together with this new band he put together for me was at this beautiful opera house in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, called the Mock Chunk Opera House. It was at one time, it was a coal mining town, but one of the richest towns in America. So one of the oligarchs, the coal oligarchs there, built this beautiful opera house for his wife. And so they have a recording studio in the place. So the place is mic'd to within an inch of its life. So we recorded the record. We recorded our first ever
live concert album.
And then we filmed it too. And wow. So it ended up on PBS. And I, again, you know, sometimes I make these decisions and I bite off way more than I can chew. But in that case, it all the stars aligned and it came out really well. I still can't believe we did that, but we did. And then Mark has been my music director ever since. And we ended up doing a Christmas record together, which I was loath to do because Christmas music drives me insane. I can't stand it. So my husband said, you should do this. Your audience would love that. So I thought, fine, I'll do it. And I thought, I'm going to make a Christmas record that I want to hear. And so I went up and I worked with Mark Doyle. And the thing about Mark is we make these records in his apartment. And
yeah,
it's a tiny, itty-bitty little studio there. It's gotten bigger since. But the thing that's so freeing is I can try things. And he records everything. And we work so well together because we know each other so well. And we have an immense respect for one another. So we can just say, no, that doesn't work. That does. We don't step on each other's toes.
Yeah, yeah.
If he doesn't like something, he tells me right away. So we got that record done and I ended up loving that record. And then I said, we should, you know, it was the lockdown and it was, I said, as I write in the book, and I don't want to get maudlin, but it was a tough time because my sister had died of ALS, a very, very horrific, fast moving ALS. I've never seen anything like it. It destroyed her within 1 year. And then my older sister was like a second mother. And then my mother, who was very elderly, she died the same year, and you know, we're locked out, and it was just bad. And I said, Mark, I gotta get myself out of this funk. And I also was feeling at the time, and this is where music just saves you. I felt like I had lost my home base. My mother and my sister were home, that home, that root for me, the roots, and they were Christmas, and and that's gone. It was just gone. And I thought, so what else is my home? And my home were those songs that I learned when I was a kid, and especially those songs when you are just starting to form your own taste. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I had my siblings who had all of their music went into my DNA. So my oldest brother was the folky in the house. So I had, think of every 60s folk artist, you know, and then Prague, and then my sister who had, you know, the Mamas and the Papas and Petula Clark and all those kind of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the girl music of the early 60s and mid 60s. And all of that was just swimming in my house all the time. But then when I turned 12, 13, 14, I had a boyfriend who liked British folk. And that was it for me. And I, Nick Drake, Five Leaves Left.
Yeah.
One. And I love Judy in the Neil Young records. Those early Neil Young records, which is not British folk, but I started learning to play the guitar playing those Neil Young songs. And I grew up in a very Catholic family, and there was a very cute young priest who played guitar, and he taught me a lot of the Neil Young songs, and I used to play them. And I would lock myself upstairs in the bathroom of our house because it had good acoustics. And I just, that was, those songs are like home to me. And I just wanted to go into a world of beauty. And so that Mark and I, we both needed that. And so we spent like those horrible dark months making this record. And it saved me, really. It brought so much joy. And when you said to me that it was like the sun for you, it brought out the sun. That's what it was for me. And I think you can feel that in it.
I definitely think so. And I think because in a lot of my videos, I say to my audience that music is the healer and the doctor. And I think that music is a big healer for people. And I also think I agree with you totally that the music we hear in our formative years never leaves us, no matter what we, whatever we discover later on. The music that happens when we're kind of like 12 to 16 is just laser etched into our memories. I mean, I Can't Get It Out of Your Head by ELO is probably, for me, it's their, it's actually my favorite song by the band.
It's mine too. Mine too. And I those songs are, you know, there's a lot of layering that goes on and big productions. But what I love is that those ELO songs have what I call good bones. You know, like when you find an old chair on the side of the road that you want to fix up and paint and maybe reupholster. Yeah. It's like you look at it and you think, this has good bones. And those songs, when you can pare them down to nothing, and or me with my minimal guitar playing, and the song still works. And that's the mark of a great song. And those ELO songs, you can pare them down that way. And they're not dependent on riffs or orchestration or anything. And for me, that song used to play on the jukebox of the cafeteria in the Catholic high school that my parents forced me to go to. And I from the moment I heard it, it had that transcendent quality, you know. It just takes hold of you. It takes you somewhere else. I love that. It still does that for me.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's like a melancholy song, but it's also uplifting. It's kind of it's just very emotive, isn't it?
It's dreamy and emotive, and a song has to take me on a journey too while I sing it. Yeah. And the mark of a great song too is you never get bored with it ever, ever. And performing it, I just never get bored with that song ever.
Fantastic. And then that's followed by Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones, which again is a very, it's a story song, isn't it? But it's full, again, full of angst and song. Yeah, it's hope.
I did read that Keith Richards, I guess, had a brief fling with some, you know, some bird, I guess, since she was sort of a free spirit, and that he wrote it about that brief fling. And I loved that song when I was a kid. I loved the Brian Jones era Stones.
Yeah.
A little bit of a classical sometimes feel to it. They were a little more orchestrated. When he died, the band, I still love them, but they went in a very, very, really more
different direction.
Very different direction. But I love Ruby Tuesday. I bought that single when I was a kid. That was one of the first singles I ever bought for
Fantastic.
On my own money. Yeah.
The next one, Tuesday Afternoon by the Moody Blues. This is one that you weren't quite sure about, where you weren't quite sure whether you could do
all
this.
Right. I'm going to be honest. I wanted to do, I mean, I love the Moody Blues and used to play them to death. And that song was so good, but the bridge, I just never thought, oh, I don't know, it's a little, you know, fairyland of love. And I thought, Mark, I don't know. We just got to reinvent that section. We just do. And I wanted, again, with Mark, I said, you know, I was thinking about Dark Side and I thought, let's put some, it needs a driving something. Why don't you let me come up with some kind of a chant here? Because we did a lot of that on Dark Side where they wanted me to do vocal stuff. And so I thought, let me think. You can always find good chants in the Bhagavad Gita because
it
happened to me when I did Dark Side of the Moon that I wanted to find that quote from Oppenheimer about because Robert Oppenheimer, the inventor of the atomic bomb, and when he first beheld it, he looked at it and apparently he was a Sanskrit scholar as well as being a physicist. And he uttered in Sanskrit, I have become death, the destroyer of worlds. And I think about it and I'm like, I got to look up that quote. I didn't realize that the in the Gita is all rhyming. It rhymes and it sings really beautifully.
Yeah, it's like a big song, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, so I found it. And so I thought, well, I had just gotten a reading from a Vedic astrologer, whatever you think of astrology, he's the best in the world. And he had given me some Vedic mantras they do. And I thought, I wonder what, it's Tuesday. There should be a mantra for Tuesday because they have mantras to the gods of each day of the week. And I looked up the mantra for the god Mars on Tuesday, and lo and behold, it sang perfectly. So I recorded it in the deepest voice I could find, layered it. We locked it in and it worked. And that's how we transformed the bridge. And that's what happens. So, and now that's my favorite part of that song. I can't wait till it comes up. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, next we're going to visit, one of my favorite artists as well is Nick Drake and River Man. Now, Nick, I remember reading, because he's such a genius, but a very sad character as well, that when he was playing his early gigs, because he had such complicated guitar tunings, he had to tune up before each one, and his guitar playing was very unique to him. So when you approached this, did you have to strip this back to a totally different?
Well, here's the deal. You know, again, that especially River Man in particular, which I just love to beyond, I can't, and I said to Mark, we just can't go down. We can't go down the guitar road here because we have to make this our own, but we have to keep, for me, the cinematic. I think Nick Drake's songs are incredibly cinematic, and we have to keep the shimmering. Most of it has a shimmering quality to it. And I said, why don't you try this on piano and see? And Mark is as good a pianist as he is a guitar player. And he just sat down and started doing this riff. And I said, that's it. And I'm going to tell you something that happened. And I, for me, that song, just whenever I sing it, it just grabs you, and you're in Nick Drake's world. Then you have to surrender to his world. And a few weeks later, after this album was released, I got a letter from Nick Drake's family, or his.
Really?
His,
wow.
The Nick Drake. And it was the person who's in charge of, I guess, the Nick Drake Legacy Foundation. And she said, whether you know this or not, what you seem to have done is to submit to the spirit of River Man before you adopted it as your own. This is often a rare, rare thing with Nick's music. So many wish to achieve, to conquer the thing, as if by doing so, it reduces it to a sport. They ended up, I don't want to get teary, but they ended up sending me a book of his mother's poetry. I'm
going to
hold this up.
Oh, yes, I've actually, I've actually got that on my bookshelf. Yeah, it's a beautiful book,
So, and with a later suggestion that maybe at some point I might want to look at the poetry that she didn't have, and maybe it's beautiful, beautiful stuff. And I love her face.
It's a beautiful, that's a beautiful set, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. It's wonderful.
It really is.
Yeah.
So that really meant a lot to me.
Oh, that's a lovely story. And Got a Feeling by the Mamas and Papas. This was this an influence from one of your sisters?
Oh my God. I mean, I sing the way I sing. Again, a lot of the British folk singers like Sandy Denny, Tabor, those kind of people. But I learned how to belt and from Mama Cass, and my sister had all of their. I remember the moment I heard that first Mamas and Papas record, and it just, I think I was 8 or 9 years old. It blew my mind. It was the most beautiful thing I had ever heard in my life. And so, of course, I sang along with it. And that was one of the more obscure songs in their whole legacy. And so I thought I should, and I thought the song should have had, the original should have had a little more of Mama Cass's swagger in it. It's a little airy, breathy. So, and again, it's one of those songs that you can easily make your own. But oh my God, I still love the Mamas and the Papas. I still play them. They're on my, you know, when I have my phone in the car and it's just scrolling through.
Yeah, they're on there.
Yeah.
The next one, Don't Let It Bring You Down by Neil Young, has been covered lots of times, but I have to say your version is just sublime. It's beautiful rendition.
I mentioned earlier why Neil Young was so meaningful to me. But that song just has such power and relevance. It never loses its relevance ever. So, you know, you can put all of your ferocity into it, you know, which is what I tried to do with that. And again, I said that if I ever get dementia or Alzheimer's or something, I have a feeling that like my hands would still know how to play that song because I've been playing it since I was a little kid.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I first got hold of the album, I was looking through the track listings, think I could see how they were all kind of, oh yes, I can see why that's on there. And then of course the next one was Comfortably Numb by Pink Floyd, which obviously when I first heard this, I didn't know you'd done Dark Side of the Moon. But Comfortably Numb again is one of those songs where you think, well, this will be interesting. But it works so well. You bring out the lyrics are easier to hear, and in a way the song now makes more sense to me. I even love the video you did.
I've always loved Pink Floyd. For me, as I mentioned earlier, I hate to keep using the word resonate, but it's the best word there is. I just resonate with the lyrics to a lot of songs and the sensibility, the philosophical outlook. And I mean, Comfortably Numb, I was trying to, with the whole record, I was trying to keep the record within a sort of maybe 6-year limit of late 60s, early 70s kind of thing. But you know, this particular song came out many years later and I said, oh, to hell with it. Let's just throw it in because I have to do a Pink Floyd song. I just do. And I always wanted to, as the Viennese say, put my mustard on it, you know? And it's one of those songs too that it's so singable, you know? And it has that crescendo. And anyway, it's another fun one. It's really fun to perform.
It's fantastic. And of course, that's also instrumentally, because obviously the song from Through the Eyes of a Pink Floyd Fan is all about David Gilmour's guitar solo. And but I think the way this has been arranged kind of is a totally different way of experiencing the song. You know, there was no need for that to have like a focal point on a guitar solo. I think the vocals are the instrumentation. That's how I've experienced it.
Yeah. I think Mark did a beautiful, beautiful job with the arrangement.
Yeah, it is. It is beautifully. In fact, all of the songs are. And in fact, one of the things I wanted to mention actually on the Neil Young one in particular is the strings, the real violins and cellos. Because a lot of people would think, well, we could probably use keyboards for this, but I think the strings on this album are fantastic.
Yeah, well, we're lucky. Mark has a group of string players, you know, that he works with all the time, and he's very, very good at writing string arrangements. And I always loved the string arrangements on two people. Well, I love the Kirby string arrangements on Nick Drake.
Brilliant. Yes. Yeah.
And, which we couldn't do on River Man. So I did a vocal thing instead. We just couldn't go there, but I also love Paul Buckman and those early, you know, all the string arrangements that he did. And so I said to Mark, give me something like, I wanted this to hit a crescendo and I wanted it to get orchestral, and that's what he came up with. And,
well, it's really good. And then you've got Since You've Asked by Judy Collins, who's another person who's been a huge influence on you.
Huge. Well, yeah, that was in my my brother, my oldest folky brother, had all of her albums, and I loved her eclecticism, and she was always a great discoverer of songwriters and good songwriter herself. And I originally used to perform this version of the song with October Project. We never recorded it. Too bad. And Emil Adler, who did an arrangement for it, did a different arrangement for it that was in sort of a different time signature. And then I ended up performing it with the Olabel people when I had them, and they kind of added their bit to it and changed the arrangement a bit. And then when it got to Mark, I said, this is the way I've been doing it all these years. And he sort of said, well, don't, if it's not broke, why fix it? So he added his thing and the string arrangement and things like that. But it's been built from the ground up since my October Project days. And I should have credited Emil on that. I didn't. I'm very sorry I didn't do that. But it, you're in a hurry when you're making these records. And but it is what it is. And I love Judy Collins. I still love her. She's a force of nature.
Yeah, she is. She's still going strong now, isn't she? Absolutely really brilliant. Yeah. Beware of Darkness by George Harrison. Was this an obvious choice?
Well, one of those early records I bought when I was a kid was All Things Must Pass.
Of course.
That record has stayed with me all these years, especially the lyrics. And I always say, like, it's so funny, George, in anybody else's hands, a lot of his lyrics would sound preachy, but with George, because George lived it, he was honest. And Beware of Darkness is such an important song. And, I always think about his buddies in that era, like, Mick and, those kind of people, those dark lords of rock. And George was so not like that, And, Jimmy Page, people like that. George was always dressed in white. But that song, those lyrics have entered my head at various points of my life and been very wise advice. And so I had to do a George Harrison tribute at City Winery with a bunch of other artists, when they do those, it was like George's birthday or something. And I thought, well, I'll do Beware of Darkness. And it went over very well. And it was just the obvious choice. And I started performing it at my solo shows. And I told Mark, it was a battle a little bit with him. I said, you have to de-Beatle it completely. You have to take every flourish out. He's like, but it's like, no, it has to, no slide, no George, all of it is gone. And I also felt that, I love George's version of it, but you just can't do that. And so I said, and again, make it more orchestral because it builds. I always, I like to build a song emotionally, where it has a payoff. Yeah. Not all songs can do that, but that song in particular, I felt could really use that. So again, Mark did that great string arrangement.
Yeah, I mean, lyrically, it's very pertinent for the times we live in, isn't it? It's,
Yeah, it happens to me all over again every time.
Yeah, and the final track is The Great Valerio, which is Richard and Linda Thompson. This is actually, as probably at the moment, my favorite track off the record.
Yeah, Now, that was the scariest one for me because I just love Linda Thompson. And I love her vocals on that. And I didn't, I really thought, what the heck are we going to do with this? And I said, Mark, again, Richard Thompson, very idiosyncratic guitar. Yeah. Can't go there at all. And because I sound, you can tell that Linda Thompson was an influence on me. Because she was. And So I thought, oh boy. So Mark is the savior of this song because he said, no, I'm going to give this a groove. And he did. And I said, you should make the outro really haunting. And he just took it to his Mark's own place. And he did that very sort of carnival-esque sounding organ at the end, yeah. Which I just, that blew me away the first time he played it for me. And I think Mark's arrangement on this is just maybe one of the most interesting ones on the whole record. He just outdid himself.
It's fantastic. Now the whole album is sequenced so well. It's yeah. I mean, it sounds like a live set. It sounds like you could just do it in that order. I mean, was that, I know a lot of people will say, oh, the songs, we just worked out roughly what we're going to do. But did you arrange the songs to be?
We think about them a lot. We sweat over those. Yeah. The sequencing and
it's fantastic.
It has to take you on a journey.
Yeah.
And we try, you know, you spend like weeks just playing, like mixing them up all the time. But I thought that the Great Valeria was a really great outro because it's got that tag on the end. And we play it live with the sequencing exactly as it is. It just works. And in fact, I'm going to Portland, Maine this weekend and we'll play the whole record all the way through.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. That'd be fantastic. Because there's a melancholy feel to the album, but at the same time, it's very uplifting. It's always the whole of the human condition is contained within this one album. The notes I made this morning were the songs bring you into the present moment and become the soundtrack to whatever you're doing at the time. Because I've noticed when me and Sue have played it in the car, traveling somewhere, it's like the soundtrack to our journey. It's like the music fits in with whatever the weather's doing and whatever we're feeling. So it's a absolutely wonderful album. I played it to my younger sons and they love it. It's
how
just
old are they?
Well, my youngest son is 24, my oldest son is 30. And my eldest son is a singer songwriter and he loves Nick Drake. So your version of Riverman's fantastic. But as I say, the whole album is just wonderful. Now the other thing I want to say is that you've also done a 5.1 mix. Everybody watching this or listening, you must buy this album. And it's quite usually when I have a 5.1 mix, it's usually a progressive rock band or it's some classic album that's being. But this for your album to be done in 5.1, which sounds beautiful, but it seems like quite an unusual decision to make. Did you always want to do that?
After Dark Side, I started, you know, I didn't promote the Dark Side 5.1 really much at all. I mean, I got it out there and then a couple of, you know, online people that are interested in, you know, groups online and on Facebook that are 5.1 aficionado, they liked it. And it was sort of a, you know, pass it around and word of mouth. And I started getting an audience that were people that were interested, you know, audiophiles. And so it was Mark said, you know, Mary, we should follow up and do this in 5.1. And there were songs on the record that were suited to like Tuesday Afternoon. And what happened was that we can't go to California, you know, it's lockdown. And
yeah,
we found out that Valhalla Studios, which is, you know, Ronald Prent and his wife, Darcy Proper, they are one of the premier surround mixer engineers, mastering engineers in the world. And his approach is very different than Clear Mountain's approach, just different style. But Ronald Prent had done a lot of work, I think it was in Belgium, where he's European, where they had studied how it doing these surround mixes, how the frequencies affect you mentally and physically and the effects. And so he has this very interesting approach.
That's interesting.
I think you feel that with this record.
When you
what the other thing is, Now, unfortunately, I live in a very old house. So it's, if you, well, you have a lot of, you know, old houses. It's yeah. little room, you know, to keep the heat in.
Yeah.
So it's hard to find a place where you can sit right in the middle of a room experience 5.1. And so I don't have that in my house. But once you've heard these things in that whole audio scenario, there's just no going back. You just don't.
I agree.
Vinyl and having a good vinyl system and that, it's 3D quality.
It's the cinematic aspect. It's because life is 3D or 4D, isn't it? I think that's why it feels so. So I've been absorbed by the songs. I can't think of the words, but you're kind of like, you sink into it. It's like a meditation almost. You just sink down it amongst the music, which again on the 5.1 disc, the bonus tracks are the strings mixes, aren't they, of Groovy Tuesday and Tuesday Afternoon, which are fantastic, absolutely beautiful.
Then you can really hear the beauty of Mark's arrangement.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. So you said that you've got some gigs coming up, haven't you, where you'll be playing this album in its entirety?
Going all over the country, Atlanta, Portland, Maine, Philadelphia, New York, probably Phoenix very soon, places like that. I just love this record so much. And I wanted to take the whole band to these various places, and I wanted people to. I play a lot of these songs by myself, but it's not the same. You know that. I wanted them to get the full feeling of this, and without, of course, the orchestra. I do have to bring a keyboard player to talk. It's also, I don't like cover records by and large, but there have been a few cover records that were very meaningful for me. One of them was that Peter Gabriel Scratch My Back record,
which, to me, that's good. Oh my God, that's
a beautiful record. Oh, and again, he just took them all and made them his own. And another one was the Jonathan Brook covers record, Back in the Circus. And she does, again, it's one of those things where she made Eye in the Sky. She did a cover of that and just made it her own and took it, made you hear. If you're going to do a covers record, you want to hear the song in a whole new way and not just be different for the sake of being different. I hate those tribute records where, they'll get some, a punk band to do a Stephen Foster song and then they just scream out.
I know exactly what you mean.
You know what I mean? Just different to be different. But what did you add? Why would I listen to that? So if you're going to do it, you have to make me want to listen to it. And anyway, that's what I really wanted to do with this record.
So if you're going to play the whole of this album in its entirety, are there other songs from your career going to be sprinkled in afterwards?
I have to do some old October project. And because
going home,
sometimes I still run into people who have never heard me solo before. And so, and I like to give the guys solo gigs around the country too, just me and a guitar. And those are just, they're more intimate, and I tell a lot of stories, but I like to give the guys in the band different moments where they can really shine and do what they do. And so the October Project songs in particular, I can let them rock out, we do that. And of course I do some of my own stuff that I've written as well. And don't know what I'm going to do next. Thinking about it, starting to put some ideas together. I have to tell you that facing the blank page is one of the scariest things if you've ever written. It's like, oh man. And so you look for inspiration, you just have to show up and do it. And I've kept notebooks and everything, and we'll see what happens.
Fantastic. So your albums are quite hard to find in the UK. So for where's the best place for people to go? Yeah, that's all right. It's
well, they can go to my website, maryfall.com. I have a really good web store there, and of course, you know, Amazon in the US has everything, but not obviously not in the UK.
If people go to your website, they can also get signed versions, can't they?
They can get signed versions. They can download some of the stuff. Especially the new record is downloadable there. And I'd love to come to the UK someday. One of these days.
Yeah,
I'll do a little tour.
But to everyone watching and listening, you need to buy a copy because you can get the 5.1 mix. And of course, everyone needs to hear this, which is The Dark Side of the Moon. Are you going to do like Us and Them or any tracks from that DVD?
Yes. Well, I always do. Even in my solo shows, I do Brain Damage and Eclipse, and sometimes we throw in some of the other songs as well. Mark loves playing the stuff from that record. And every so often we'll do if we do two sets, not this time, but if we do two sets, we'll do the first half as a regular set, and the second half we come back and we do the show. We do the entirety of Dark Side.
Wow.
And at the time when we got signed to V2, the guys from V2 Records flew up to Syracuse and we performed it for them in this tiny little toolbox theater. But I had gotten the local university, their theater department. I called them up. It was the summer and said, "Is anybody there? Like, can I get some interns?" And they built a little stage for me.
Wow.
And I was dating someone at the time who put together all of these different films for me. And sort of, if you know the filmmaker Maya Deren, they're like weird.
You've
never taken a cinema course. So he put together these strange films, but really well done. And so we had that going at the same time. And it was sort of a multimedia experience. And so I still do that. I wanted to make it a real in-depth. I mean, we don't have the light show that a typical Pink Floyd would have, but the show is just incredibly fun to perform. And we'll still do that on occasion, perform the thing in its entirety.
Yeah, because just before we finish, on your live album, because I mean, there's like as opera, English folk, there's pop. Is there a particular vocal style you're happiest doing, or do you just see it all as part of who you are now?
It's all part of, you know, who I am. And I know it's odd that I would have gotten signed to a classical label to sing. Opera is not my favorite, but I did do, I love French classical music, and no one's ever going to sign me to a deal to do French, but just for my own self, I made a little record of French, you know, Debussy and Ravel and Satie.
Wow.
And I made it in a folky way. And it's one of those things like, as if I wasn't eclectic enough, like throw that into the mix. But I have to say, if I had a favorite music to sing, it would be that, because that's like the music of my soul. But I do it in a sort of, like if Nick Drake did French classical music, it would sound like that. So that's what I've done. I'll release that someday. You know,
that's something for us all to look forward to.
I'll send you one of the cuts if you'd like.
Yes, please. Well, thank you so much, Mary, for all of your time. And I wish you the best for your upcoming tour and for this fantastic album, Everybody, which you need to buy.
Thanks.
And go to maryfall.com, where you can get signed. Yes. Yes, for all of us in the UK, it's Mary Fall, but it's spelt F-A-H-L, in case you go and Google and they can't find you straight away. But thank you so much for your time today, Mary. It's been absolutely wonderful to talk to you. And please keep me informed how the tour goes. And hopefully I'll talk to you again soon. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, watching and being here for the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And a huge thank you to my guest, Mary Fall. And please check out her album, Can't Get It Out of My Head, which is highly recommended. Check out the Now Spinning website at nowspinning.co.uk. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, to the website, to the podcast, and join us also on our social media channels. And I look forward to seeing you on my next episode.